This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
It's Thursday. Welcome to the Business Report. You're on Nova 1035. I'm Gary Strubel. And for the next hour or so, we're going to take you on a bit of a trip around all the biggest stories here in Namibia. We'll start out with the lead story. The Honourable Minister Kalle Schletwein, the Minister of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, talks to us and gives us a bit of an update on what's happening with the green schemes and also Nicotol. We'll be talking to Abraham Nahimia, the NamWater CEO, in the spotlight. And he's picked an interesting song showing his patriotism. Stuart Lohman catches us up with all the stuff on Biz News. Cons Karamata will catch us up on the Green Hydrogen Conference that took place in Windhoek this week. And then Namib Mills turns 40. And we catch up with Ian Collard, the CEO of Namib Mills. Then Romain Mostert has an opportunity for you if you're interested in investing in agriculture in Namibia. Cirrus have something you might want to hear. All of that and more coming up in the show. But now it's time for the Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of Biz News.
With your Biz News, I'm Charlize Maslengle. South Africa's central bank governor urged authorities to take urgent action to prevent the nation being added on Global Watchdog's grey list of countries that aren't doing enough to stop the flow of dirty money. Google's Equano subsea internet cable has made its way to South Africa, recently landing at Telkom's facility in Melkbosstrand, completing the course from Portugal along the west coast of Africa. The Saudi economy is expected to grow 7.6% this year, up from 3.2% in 2021 on the back of soaring oil revenues, the International Monetary Fund said Wednesday. And oil edged 1% higher after earlier hitting a six-month low on Wednesday as a steeper-than-expected drawdown in U.S. crude stocks outweighed concerns over rising output Russian exports and recession fears. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Time now for the lead story, and the lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Now, the 11 Green Scheme irrigation farms in Namibia will be put out on the market this year through request for proposals. This is from the Minister of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Kalle Schletwein. Minister, welcome to the Business Report. It's we checked in with you a couple of months ago and you promised some action on this, and we see some action happening. Let's give us a little bit of an update on what is happening with the Green Scheme farms.
Well, good afternoon. I'm happy to be back. Well, the Green Scheme farms, as have been said, and as we have committed to in the Harambe 2 prosperity plan, will be outsourced to private entities through which we want to empower Namibians and improve production in the same way or at the same time. We have started with the advertisement of one, that was the Vungu Vungu dairy green scheme. We have received our proposals. We are now evaluating that, and it will be hopefully soon awarded. We have taken the second step and asked for proposals for three brownfield green schemes. That is the Tankies Copper in the south that feeds off the Orange River, the Zone green scheme, it's a large green scheme in Kabango West, and then the Katima Mulilo Liselo green scheme that feeds off the Zambezi River in the Zambezi region. Those are two large green schemes. They are larger than the other conventional ones that we have. And they are brownfield because there's no infrastructure provided as yet. That is part of the proposal that we expect, that includes the development of the infrastructure and then the operation of the green scheme for a time to be agreed upon. Of course, we are very much aware that the investor needs some time to recoup the investment, and that will be taken good care of. There are the others, the greenfield green schemes that are also coming. Those are the ones where we have provided the infrastructure. The lands and the fields are developed.
Minister, perhaps I can just stop you at that and just let's. Can I ask you about the Vungu Vungu one? Now, I understand these are, I would imagine, are relatively confidential processes. It's a competitive bid, so I've got two questions for you. Firstly, what sort of interest did it attract? Were there lots of guys wanting to get involved? And secondly, what are the critical elements that you adjudicate around the concept of competitiveness here?
We only got one offer, so it is not a great number that we received. Unfortunately, it's one offer, but it's an offer that appears on face value, a realistic one. Our expectation is that we can significantly improve agricultural production. And in this specific one, in a diversified manner. It's the first green scheme where we diversify a livestock element with an horticultural element. That is the dairy production with a green scheme. That is a grain or whatever horticultural production green scheme, irrigated, of course. Now, we leave it up to the bidder to develop the business plan. We do not want to be prevailing on them because it is their business, it's their investment. Our dividend that we get from this project is the increased production, a closer movement towards self-sufficiency with grains, and an additional component, that's the diversification component, a dairy production in the northern part of the country, which has no dairy production whatsoever, but dairy products, milk, essential food element for especially children. And we believe that that is absolutely crucial in the north, that we develop the infrastructure to provide that.
Okay.
We believe our function as government is to provide that facility and facilitate the development of basic infrastructure that our citizens then can take charge of and make a living from. Our dividend are the jobs, the food security that we get, and economic growth.
Just give us an indication of the time frame that elapses. There's a number of other green schemes. They include Orange River, Hardap, Etunda, Musesi, Sikonde, Ndongo, Lenena, Mushari. So there's a number still to come. How long does it take from the time you advertise for competitive bidding and then conclude the process by awarding it? How long does that take?
It depends a little bit on the project. I think the brownfields and the Vungu Vungu one will take a little bit longer because it's a more complex green scheme than or comparison to a going concern like the other green schemes are.
Right.
And Neckartal is, for instance, one of the brownfields that is very complicated, very large, and we anticipated a little bit of a longer run-up period to develop and conclude an agreement with the investor. We hope that we can get most of the greenfield green schemes sorted before the growing season in December.
Okay, that's so an that ambitious they get target.
Into production, or some of them, or the majority of them, maybe. But we have to be ambitious because we cannot leave this infrastructure idle for too long.
Of course.
If we can't get them sorted out into a outsourcing arrangement, of course, where possible, we will run them as is with our own manager and our own inputs, which is suboptimal, but they will not be running idle.
Okay. Well, that's a firm commitment. Let's just quickly take a look at, there seems to be a lot of energy at the moment from Namibian government around direct foreign investment in a number of different sectors. We know the energy sector suddenly has come to life. Has there been, and are you actively seeking, international investment into this agricultural space?
We have decided to be completely open. We believe agriculture is by and large a domestic activity. So we prefer Namibian entities either on their own as domestic investors or in association with with foreign partners to take the cue here. We believe that agriculture is not anymore a non-technical business. It has now serious technology incorporated in its activities, and there is a need to get that technology transferred into our own farming community. So there is a distinct possibility and opportunity for joint ventures where we can get that about. But the principle that agriculture and the ownership of land is for the citizens is embedded in that concept.
Perhaps you can just give us an overall reading of the current state of agriculture in Namibia.
Well, agriculture is still in an difficult situation. We have these two large sectors. It's the livestock producing sector and the crop producing and horticultural sector. On the livestock sector, I believe we are in a recovery process. We have seen in the last financial year and in the first two quarters pretty solid growth. So we have managed to turn that sector from a decline into a growing situation. So I'm optimistic. It is growing, but there are still some aspects that are not optimal. First of all, we are now facing a closure of the border with South Africa because the foot and mouth outbreak in South Africa. So our export trade of wieners with South Africa is in jeopardy. We have foot and mouth disease problems in the northern part, so our own export is limited to a smaller number of markets than we could have had without the disease. And we are recovering out of a drought, so we are having a restocking phase and a phase where the livestock production must be aligned to produce more into our own value chain, that is to produce more slaughter-ready cattle so that our abattoirs become viable again, and then find a new balance between on the hoof or raw material exports vis-a-vis finished products, that is meal-ready portions or fresh meat. Now, our abattoirs are in a current situation where none of them is viable because of a lack of throughput. So we have issues, but we are recovering and we are getting towards a situation which is better. On the horticultural side, well, we have talked many times about the problems that we had at Green Schemes. They were managed up suboptimally by far. Production rates were actually quite pathetic. We were more depending on dryland produced grains than on irrigated grains, which is a sad story. With this outsourcing, we believe we turned it also around, and we had a very good season on the dryland side. So on grain, on maize, we moved much closer to self-sufficiency than we ever were before. So we are now over 100,000 tons, I think 120,000 tons is the estimate of what we will get this year. So we are doing fine. We are doing very, very well in high-value crops like dates, blueberries, and grapes. So again, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but agriculture as a whole is growing at about 4.5-5%, and that is a great achievement, I believe, in the last 2 years, where we turned from a declining trend into a positive trend anymore. Let me just link it to Green Schemes. If our Green Schemes are all operated in a optimal manner, they alone will produce enough to be self-sufficient. And then we can really diversify in fodder production, in other crops, in dryland production, which assist us, like sunflowers, sunflower oil. And then I believe we are in a much better situation to really develop the agricultural sector in a diversified manner, where we can diversify horizontally and vertically. That will be the optimum of what we are achieving.
Minister, that's what we have time for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the Business Report. Always a pleasure to hear, and it's wonderful to hear that we have ambitious targets set to get these things up and running. Congratulations on good growth numbers coming out of agriculture, and we'll check in soon and have a chat.
I would be keen to do that again. Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to eat own produced food soon. Thank you.
That is the Minister of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Kalish Letwine, telling us that the green schemes are progress is being made, and they hope to have many of those up and running by the time the growing season hits us. The lead story was brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. From one agricultural story to another, you heard the minister speak about abattoirs, and we had a story a couple of months ago about Savannah Beef Processors and Cirrus acting on their behalf. Romain Morsted, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Goody.
Right, so it's been an interesting old time. You guys were blown away by your initial subscription you put out for investors for the Savannah Beef. You guys are acting on behalf of Savannah Beef Processors, looking to put up a new abattoir in the country. Just remind us, you went out looking for 100 million and you did way better.
Yeah, we've got a total equity need of 200 million. But the whole time the idea was, let's try and get 100 million from producers so that the producers can be in control of their own destiny and have a controlling interest in the abattoir. And then they completely surprised us, and we got 146 million from producers in the first round of capital raising. The intent always was then to go to other investors and seek the residual amount to get to the 200 million. However, because of the interest and the subsequent interest being shown, we decided to open up again to producers for a second time. So we still need to raise 54 million from producers. And the reason we're going back to them is, first of all, to get if we can get more than 75% interest from producers, I think it's just that very strategic shareholding for producers to have. And then also, if we can potentially get the full amount from producers, I mean, that's an absolute win. Something we never thought we would achieve. But if producers could have funded this abattoir themselves, that's really, I think, the ultimate goal.
I mean, you're not far off 75%. You need another 4 million to get there in terms of your projections.
Yes.
Okay, so just remind us again. In order to be able to make an investment, so this is a second chance for guys who missed out on the first round or might have been a bit negative about it. How do you qualify to want to make an investment?
Yeah, so this is a private placement, which means it's only sent out to select investors who can participate. In order to qualify as a select investor, you either need to be a member of the Beef Value Chain Forum, or you need to be a beef producer registered with the Meat Board of Namibia, which basically means you have a stock brand card and you've got a mark for your cattle.
What percentage of beef producers in the country didn't partake in the first round?
Sure, that statistic is difficult for me to say. What I do know is we've got we had 548 investors or producers participating in the first round, which I think is quite a significant amount. At the end, I think as the private placement got momentum, there was a lot of guys that just came in with a minimum required amount just to be part of it, and I hope they can actually get us through to the 200 million mark this time around.
Okay, so this opens up on Friday, and
yes.
Guys are interested or they want more information, they can get hold of you guys at on the Cirrus website?
Yes. So because we only have, I say only now, but we only have 54 million left to raise.
How your tune has changed.
The tune has changed a bit. The allocation process is going to be on a first come, first serve basis. So the moment we go over 54 million, we will just close it. And on the day we go over 54, we will do a pro rata allocation to the guys that participated on that day. So we encourage people to rather apply for shares sooner rather than later to make sure they don't have any misfortune.
If they want in, get in quickly.
Yes, exactly.
Saying. All right, let's nuts and bolts this a little bit. I want to invest. What is the minimum required investment?
Okay, so we're issuing shares in lots of 4,000 shares at $1 each. So it's basically $4,000 per minimum subscription and then multiples thereof. The logic for this is the slaughtering capacity of this abattoir will be 50,000 animals a year, and we need 200 million equity. So if you divide it by, it basically means you put down your $4,000 for every animal you want to slaughter in the future.
And how long are you going to keep it open until it's subscribed?
The official closing date's the 9th of September. So if we're not fully subscribed by then, it will close. If we are fully subscribed before then we will close on that date it goes oversubscribed.
All right. Now, in this show, on an interview we had slightly earlier with the Minister of Agriculture, Kalish Letwein, he made mention in his answer to a different question about the non-viability of abattoirs currently due to lack of slaughtering capacity, lack of stock to slaughter. Talk to us about that for a second.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I think if you look at the slaughtering statistics at the moment, amount of animals going out of the country, for the first 6 months, we stood at 15,000 animals that's been slaughtered at local abattoirs south of the veterinary cordon fence. At the peaks, Namibia was slaughtering 200,000 animals a year for export purposes. I think the reason people are not slaughtering as much is because of the lack of trust in the system. The existing abattoirs have really failed to pay producers on time as agreed to in the past, and this might give you a lack of confidence if you will receive your money if you deliver your animals now. And I think if you can get the interest in our project shows you the interest to bring animals. People are not thinking in terms of how much dollars I want to invest, it's how much animals I actually want to slaughter a year. Right. And with our first raising, you could see basically, we've got a commitment of 36,500 animals already per year, and we're looking to take that now to 50,000 with getting the rest of the 200 million. Namibia's inability to export cattle at the moment, we've got a niche market overseas, and our inability to do that at the moment is because of inefficiencies in the existing abattoirs. They're operating at way too expensive costs, which means if you get your X price overseas, you are unable to pay the producer here what you need to, because in between there's too much cost lined up. And there we need to focus on getting new technologies installed in this abattoir to unlock to remove some of those inefficiencies. And then ultimately we can pay our cattle producers way more. If the price is right, the animals will be there. And if you look at Australia's cattle market, for example, they export to exactly the same markets as we. But their producer gets on average $110 million per kilogram equivalent, where our producers get $60 or less. So if the price is right, the animals will be there and the farmer will make sure he's got product to deliver.
Okay, last question, because I know you've got things to go off and do, and so do we. Let's ask the tough question. Competing with government, which is effectively what you guys are setting up, is a direct competitor to state-owned facility. Which is already being touted by the minister as non-viable. So that's why I asked the question. It kind of puts you in the crosshairs sometimes a little bit. And how are you guys anticipating dealing with government? Doesn't always take kindly to people going up against them.
So first of all, if you look at the export markets, we are dropping the ocean. And we're not really competing in terms of where we need to deliver product. Where we are perhaps competing is sourcing product or animals in Namibia. But there's more than enough capacity. As I mentioned, so this year so far, animal slaughtered year is 15,000. We intend to bring up capacity of 50,000 a year. Namibia at one point in time actually slaughtered 200,000 animals a year for export purposes. So we don't have to compete. We also don't think Savannah sees himself as a competitor to any of the other abattoirs in the market. Instead, they want to be complementary to each other, serving the same purpose of getting enough throughput to serve the markets overseas. So it's really not about competing. It's just sort of taking destiny in its own hands. If you look at where we come from and where we are at the moment, there's clearly something not right in the structure.
Ray Mostert from Cirrus, representing Savannah Beef Processors, looking to raise another $54 million on a $200 million capital raise to build a privately held and privately placed abattoir here in Namibia. It opens on Friday. More information on the Cirrus website. First come, first serve. Good luck with the capital raise. It's exciting.
No, thanks a lot. We appreciate the opportunity to talk here.
This is the Business Report on Nova 103.5.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
In today's Spotlight, we're speaking to Mr. Abraham Nehemiah, who has been serving as the Chief Executive Officer of the Namibia Water Corporation since the 3rd of January 2019. Hello, Mr. Nehemiah.
Very good morning.
Now, we know that you've got a rich background in water affairs. You've served at institutions such as the National Planning Commission, as well as the Directorate of Water Affairs under the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Forestry. But could you tell us a bit more about your background, where you were born, your studies, and what your first job was?
Yeah, no, I was born at a village called Engela, just close to Oshikango at the Namibia-Angolan borders. And that's where I grew up, going both then to the lower primary school and also looking after my parents' livestock. I studied up to standard six at Engela Primary School, and then was one of those students who at that time identified as very good students to go to the missionary school called Oshigambo High School. That school generally was only attended by the number ones at all the primary schools in the north. So it was all the number ones brought together. So that's where I then ended up did my studies up to that time standard eight, and then I had to leave the country. So then I happened while in exile go to the then East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, is abbreviated GDR at that time. So when Germany was split into two. And there I did my political science diploma before returning back, and eventually got back to Namibia at independence. Then proceeded to do my my matric, which I did not have finished there when I was at Oshigambo High School. Got that, and then I went to the UK where I did my first degree and a master's degree in water and environmental sciences. And then later on did my master's as well, and ended up also doing my administration degree, is the MBA. With the UNAM and Maastricht University. So that's how I featured in terms of doing my studies.
Interestingly there, you mentioned that one of the first qualifications was the political science diploma. So what led you to water rather than parliament or the presidency?
Yeah, upon the independence of the country, what happened is that I started working at the National Planning Commission, where I was then attached to the expert who came to do the first national census. So we were going around the country doing the training of the enumerators, the people who had to do the counting of the people. Training them, taking them through everything, giving them the necessary materials. And something happened the day when we were just starting with the counting of the people. The person was supposed to do the counting in the Olympia suburb just resigned that evening. And now to train somebody new was difficult. So I had to just take up that job to do it myself. So, and when I was doing the counting, I ended up in the house of the director of water. And we entered into the discussions, and he just said, look, you are the person I've been looking for to help me to make people understand the importance of water and what they need to do to contribute to ensuring that the country has got water for everybody. So this must be your last day at the National Planning Commission. Tomorrow I want you in my office and you get into water. So that's actually how it just happened. It just was just a spontaneous thing that I happened to be in water, and I'm there up to today.
Mm. Well, it's a good thing that you did end up in that house, because your involvement in international water issues, I mean, especially in the Southern African Development Community, you've helped contribute to the development of river basin organizations like the Zambezi Commission, the Kunene Permanent Joint Technical Commission, amongst others, including along the Orange River. How does working on those sorts of commissions, though, differ from the day-to-day of running NamWater and making sure that everyone in Namibia has access to water?
The most important thing in dealing with international waters is diplomacy. So you must be somebody who is able to listen to the others, but still remain steadfast on the position of your own country. And that, for you to be able to do that, you must have a broad understanding of what the issues are. So that when you are arguing, from the basis of facts and not listening to what others are saying, then react to what they are saying. You must be able always to tell you that, although we see the things like that from the Namibian perspective, because of ABCD, this is how we see things happening, so that at the end of the day, we are all beneficiaries. So it's an issue of really diplomacy and broad understanding of issues. But I really enjoyed working with all these commissions and knowing almost all the key people and senior guys in the water sector in the whole SADC region. It was a very interesting initiative.
In terms of those agreements and your involvement in them, would you say that Namibia is getting her fair share of those resources?
The critical thing here is, as I say, diplomacy plays a role, is that we understand each other, but we also find situations where we agree to disagree. So there are certain things which I would say, as a country, we still have to work on those to make sure that we get our fair share. But the critical thing is that we understand each other, that this is the issue and here is a problem because Namibia is saying this and other countries are saying that. So that's something that's ongoing for us to really ensure that at the end of the day, Namibia gets its fair share.
Speaking of getting to know people, each week to get a little bit more of an insight into our guests, we ask them to choose a song for us that we can play for them. While I'm not expecting the Water Boys or Take Me to the River, I am curious as to whether there'll be a water theme in your song choice. What have you chosen for us today?
Definitely, it's in there, but it might be a bit hidden because I didn't go far. I just, when I have to sing, the song that comes to my mind every time, and it happens wherever I go, is our national anthem.
Welcome back to the Spotlight feature on Nova 103.5's The Business Report, where today we're talking to NamWater CEO Abraham Nehemia. Mr. Nehemia, before we listen to your song choice, we were discussing your involvement with international water commissions and your day-to-day duties as CEO, which obviously brings with it its own challenges. What are some of the more major hurdles that you faced in your time as NamWater CEO, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, the challenge which what I see when I wake up every day is actually ensuring that every Namibian has access to water. And as we speak, not all of them have access to water. And the trouble here is that we do not have the necessary systems in place to ensure that everybody has that water. Infrastructure set up, either some are too old or there are areas which are not covered at all. And sometimes you see also sort of reports where people are even getting water from traditional wells and all those kind of things. So that's my major trouble, that I am here calling myself a CEO responsible for a water company, but there are people in this country who are still not having access to water.
Mm.
So the last 2.5 years, I've been working hard, looking at how do we as a company mobilize more resources and funds to be able really to both make sure that all those old infrastructure are replaced, and that those areas that are not covered yet get the necessary water supply systems. So we could mobilize large amounts of money, and I have honestly to thank the central government here, because they really assisted us in obtaining funds from international financial institutions like the African Development Bank and the German Reconstruction Bank, KfW, and then we are also doing the best to mobilize our own resource internally so that we can really look into how do we really look into this infrastructure that is old, and also to look at the areas that's not covered, because that is my major problem. People in independent Namibia after so many years without access to water. Although the if you look at Namibia and many other African countries, our coverage is quite significantly high in terms of the coverage. But me, I'm looking at every Namibian to enjoy the same benefits in terms of access to water.
In terms of that goal, what's the key leadership message then that you're trying to get your team to take to heart?
What message I'm giving my team every day is that everything stands and falls on leadership. And the customer is your boss. So if the team, the management team, is not doing things that are going to really take us to that goal, we must forget. People cannot go without towards a certain goal or vision without a strong leadership. And I, even when I talk to them, I even tell them stories like, when I have been growing up, like I said, I've been looking after my father's cattle. But sometimes I even come and open the gate for the crow. But unless that leading bull or cow stands up, all the cattle will be lying there.
Mm.
And when it gets out of the crow, it shows the direction where they are going. They just follow. So if the leadership of the company is not doing what's expected from them, then everything will follow on that leadership. So that is the key message, actually, that I'm really giving out every day. And I'm hammering up on daily basis on how we have to create really a team, because it cannot be a one-man show in terms of taking this company forward to achieving its objectives.
Touching on that leadership by example element then, what would you say is your biggest accomplishment since taking over the reins at NamWater?
The first thing was to make sure that, then bring people together. Bring the people together and make sure then that they understand what's expected from them. So I worked on a new company strategy, which really is creating awareness to every individual staff member to know what they have to do to contribute to the overall goal of the company. And this has started to take shape already, both at the leadership level and also at the operational level. Things are getting into shape now, and it's because of really hammering on ensuring that we have a clear strategic framework for the company where we are going, clear objectives, clear measures of how we are measuring our performance and our key performance indicators. So it's really strategically taking the company in a direction which is very, very clear for everyone. And I'm really proud that we have achieved this so far. Now it's really making sure that we are putting pressure in terms of implementation and we are doing the necessary evaluation and monitoring as we go, so that by 2027 we have achieved the targets and the objectives we set ourselves.
Well, we wish you all the success in achieving those. Thank you so much, Mr. Namia.
Thank you.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything. Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 1035. And as always, every time this week, we pop our heads over the fence and we have a look at South Africa with our partners down there, BizNews. And Stuart Lohman is always joining us on the line. Stuart, welcome. Let's start out with electricity. We know South Africa's got lots of it at the moment, and they're looking what to do with it, so they'll stick it in some cars. There's a very interesting story that I saw posted on the site about the adoption of electric vehicles. And there's also, you know, a lot of concern about the potential impact of South Africa being too liberal with allowing electric vehicles in too quickly, with the whole labor chain, parts, supplies, what happens to motor dealers. There's a lot of unanswered questions in this space. And South Africa almost seems caught between a rock and a hard place in protecting the industry that exists and allowing the new industry to unfold.
No, I mean, you mentioned electricity there, Gary, and yes, load shedding is back. So that's the first port of call is, where is it all going to come from? But there are plans, apparently. There's a 2030 plan, but we won't get into that now. The article you referred to, a partner of ours, Bronwyn, spoke to Tabang Maklanga from Nedbank, and they sort of looked at, you know, they're looking at sort of new energy, et cetera, and obviously electric vehicles came into the discussion. I suppose the key, what you see on the ground as well is quite interesting. We've seen recently Audi open a few of these charging stations. Is, you know, they're starting to pop up all over the place. So it's almost like the trend is coming. But as is South Africa, we're a few years behind and things take, well, you mentioned the unions. There's always concern amongst unions on jobs, et cetera, with new technology. The argument is that if you can look beyond the initial, it actually opens up opportunities, you know, new learnings, new skill sets, et cetera. So I suppose that's always the challenge with new things. Once, you know, especially on the job market, especially in a country where we've perceived to have 60 to 70% youth unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. So interesting story, good for the environment, et cetera, but obviously some union challenges going forward and hopefully we move forward from there.
Also part of the debate around this is if we're charging these cars with coal-fired electricity, yeah, you know, what are we actually doing?
Yeah, you're giving up the one for the other. So completely. I suppose that's where the push is for renewables from at the source. So let's see where that goes. I mean, like we've been speaking about renewable energy plans for years now, but that is part of the plan. So fix the source as well as the output, then maybe you have the right solution.
Well, we'll certainly have some electricity to send down your way soon. So there's big plans here in Namibia to build all sorts of things. Bain & Co., another fascinating story. They took the very unusual measure of taking out a full-page advert in the Business Day. I mean, just taking out an advert in a newspaper is cute. But saying South Africans, you know, need to know the truth. But it would seem that their idea of the truth and what seems to be widely the accepted versions of the truth don't really match up.
Yeah, so there's a piece from Nicole Fritz from the Helen Suzman Foundation, Gary, and it's interesting. I mean, because obviously this week we've also said, you know, the open letter came out from Bain to apologize for everything that happened. And we always use Eskom as the main proponent, but there's concern that it was across a lot of the SEOs, you know, during the state capture years. And yeah, it's sort of almost like Nicole's like in your, you know, you're not, how can we open dialogue when you're not sort of admitting to what actually happened. There's concerns around what they're saying happened and what actually happened. So, yeah, it's a strange one, as you say as well. You know, take out a newspaper ad, surely should have been digital. It probably would have been a lot cheaper as well, but we won't get into the schematics behind. But
yeah. Of course, Biden now reacting to Lord Peter Hain has been very vocal in the UK about, and he seems to have caught Boris Johnson's ear somewhere, about Bain being removed from doing business with the British government, and largely as a result of this. And I mean, there's no question that Bain has not acted with either transparency or integrity once it became evident that there had been some wrongdoing. So, you know, how much sympathy is there for them at the moment in South Africa?
Yeah, not much, Gary, to be honest, on the ground. Like you say, the UK took some action. I think there's a 3-year ban on using Bain sort of within government. And South Africa sits on its hands as well. So it's quite, sitting on the ground, it's interesting to see, how we move forward. But there's not much sympathy. I think I'm sure there's other companies with the same skill sets that we can move forward with at present.
So let's turn now to big story on the site. Another company that has become evident now acted massively inappropriately on a global scale is Pfizer. This is big stuff. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so there's a story. There's a sort of vaccine report that's been released that's come to fruition that shows the sort of certain not outcomes, I suppose it's vaccines sort of impacts of vaccines on health. It doesn't look pretty. It wasn't sort of given to the public. It was picked up. Andrew Kenny wrote a piece about it, highlighted some of the issues. But what's interesting about this, when we spoke off air, Gary, was we ran the story on Instagram, which actually got pulled off Instagram. So, I mean, there might be concerns as well with information in the report,
etc.
This morning it got pulled off the
and
post.
And when it gets pulled off, do they give you notice? Do they fine you up? Or does it just get removed and you don't see it?
It gets removed and you get a little, this post has been suspended.
Okay.
So the social media manager got that. And I mean, we've had problems with this throughout the COVID sort of pandemic from when it started. Certain information has been cut out, etc., on certain social platforms. We've had a few videos pulled off YouTube, etc., as well. So it's a very testy sort of area. But yes, this report is quite damning, and let's see where we go. Again, it's just come to fruition. The people are picking up on it. As you mentioned, very, very viral in terms of the people who've read it on site. So yeah, let's see. Because, I mean, if you also agree, reflect back on what we've spoken about with regards to mandatory vaccinations, etc., if this information was on hand prior to such a rollout globally, there's got to be heads to roll. I'm not saying what's true or not, but there has to be some sort of outcome from this.
But I just want to stop a second on that, because this is a big issue in the media space, and media, and we both form part of that sector, get blamed for being biased around everything. We now do live in a very binary, polarized society, and it seems to me, from my basic readings and from the little bit I've gleaned from the site as well, I mean, it's not in contestation that Pfizer deliberately held back information that may have proved material to how people saw that vaccine in the beginning. That doesn't seem to be under any sort of dispute. So the controversy around this is in the facts. Pfizer themselves have released this report. They themselves have, obviously under duress, but have sent this out into the world some months ago. So what sort of appeal process do you have with a platform like Twitter or Instagram when your stuff gets removed?
There is no appeal. We've tried, Gary. Our biggest one, we had a video on COVID vaccines pulled off YouTube. There's no sort of remorse. We actually got closed for, I think it was 2 weeks. We weren't allowed to publish any of the content, et cetera. Mm. So the guidelines, they've got guidelines from World Health Organizations, et cetera, that they stick to. There's no debate. They don't offer any sort of alternative. So yeah, so it's interesting on the media space. I know we probably don't have too much time, but it's like you say, no matter what you write about, you sort of get attacked from either side. But if you if people see the media as a platform where you need to offer these different opinions, you know, you can't be sort of closing one off just because it's what you think. You don't bring emotion into it. It's a platform. It's got to be an unbiased platform, a neutral platform. But you get sort of stringed a new one when you put different views on. But that's important for dialogue, important for people to sort of build their own messaging from what's happening out there, et cetera. So very discussion probably for another day.
Interesting times. Stuart, thank you so much. That's what we've got time for today. Good luck taking on the Zuck. And, of course, if you want to read that story, it's been taken off Instagram. If you want to read it, it is on biznews.com about Pfizer and possible malfeasance, and certainly not the highest levels of integrity being shown in the very early stages of COVID testing. Fascinating story. Stuart, thanks. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Gary.
That's Stuart Lohman from biznews.com, and that's it for this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Let's turn our attention now to the Market Watch, and this evening's Market Watch is about energy, and I suspect we'll have many more in the future on this topic. Green hydrogen is poised to become a critical source of energy markets, playing an increasingly central role in the transition to a green energy future. The first Namibian Green Hydrogen Conference was hosted by the Namibia Investment Promotion and Development Board, together with the Economic Association of Namibia, in collaboration with all development partners, facilitating conversations and ensuring that capital inflows into this emerging sector will lead to the development of an integrated industrial base in Namibia. Our producer, Angie Skoltz, speaks to Cons Karamata, the CEO of EAN.
Thank you so much, Mr. Karamata, for taking time to speak to us. Yes, you just concluded the conference. Tell us how it went.
Well, I think that this is easily one of the best conferences that I've ever attended in Namibia. Of course, as the organizer, it might be not very objective to make a real assessment of the conference, but the feedback that we received from so many delegates was that really this was a fruitful conference. People have learned a lot, especially the whole issue of demystifying green hydrogen. People are better informed what it is, and they see it now as something that is tangible and that can actually happen in Namibia.
Mr. Karamata, what would you say would be the key takeaways emanating from this conference?
Well, the key takeaways is really that we need to, as a nation, move together to take our country to a better place. In order for us to do that, we need to take advantage of the opportunities now being created by the expected huge investments flowing into the country in the area of green hydrogen. And so we have learned that there are opportunities, there are value chains that are going to open up. There's infrastructure that need to be put in place for the production to take off. Jobs will be created. So we need to capacitate ourselves. That's the takeaway. We need to get ready. We need to, businesses need to start to forge relations and linkages to others, to other businesses that are in that area, especially from outside the media. So people in different areas and according to their different fields need to start preparing. Young people need to start identifying areas of study that will be aligned and the type of jobs that will be needed. So we don't want just foreigners to come and work in these industries. We want our own people to be capacitated, and the opportunities are opening up. Our academic institutions are coming up with programs. So students need to move into these areas and get the skills that will be required. These are very high-skilled areas. And they need to then start working on this already now, before production starts.
So did the conference unpack the potential new markets that would exist in terms of storing green hydrogen and transporting thereof as an income stream to upcoming entrepreneurs or possible existing SOEs?
Yeah, okay. So those are some of the infrastructure that needs to be put in place that relate directly to the production of green hydrogen and the transportation thereof. We were told at the conference that the best way to transport green hydrogen is through pipelines. So those pipelines need to be put in place. Those are opportunities for job creation. We also heard that the markets are getting ready. There is a whole lot of demand internationally for green hydrogen because countries are moving towards decarbonizing their economies. And these markets will expand. There is not enough green hydrogen being produced at the moment. There is what is called gray hydrogen, which is not entirely clean. And therefore, because of the international agreements that have been signed, countries need to move towards cleaner energy, and green hydrogen is that. And Namibia is best suited on the African continent to produce this green hydrogen cost effectively.
So what economic benefit could be identified for the country from the conference? Did any additional interest come from the foreign investors at the conference?
Okay, so as I pointed out, there are various value chains. So at first, we have the actual production process of green hydrogen, which mostly will be carried out by foreign investors because we just don't have the technology to do that. But then there is a whole lot of value chains related to that will be opening up. There are byproducts. We can be involved in fertilizer production. We can be involved in other chemical industry production that can really be a byproduct of green hydrogen. But then there's opportunities around tourism, there's opportunities around consulting, there's opportunities around logistics. So quite a number of value chains that are part of that ecosystem. And clearly, we were even told by a company from Germany that it is possible with German technology to be producing solar panels locally in India. It is not a far-fetched idea. It is something that can be done. It's a question of engaging them. It's a question of collaboration. It's a question of training people. So, and that would be wonderful if Namibia is able to produce solar panels, not only for the local market, but also to export in collaboration with German companies.
Then, sir, also, if you could tell us, were the environmental impacts considered which might flow from the developments of this new market, and how would these impact on the local economy while we are waiting to see what the regulations on the sector would look like?
Okay, so we had a whole session on that topic. We had legal experts, environmental lawyers, discussing that and looking at what needs to be placed in terms of legislative framework to protect our environment. That is key, since this is going to be clean energy. You don't want to damage our pristine environment to create a product that will be self-defeating. And therefore, these efforts are already underway. Studies are already being done to make sure that the production of green hydrogen and related industries will not harm our environment.
Right. Mr. Karimata, just a last question. How would the development of this sector seek to realize the advancement of the economic prosperity as planned for the Harambe Prosperity Plan 2?
Okay, so while Europe is talking about pollution and trying to bring down pollution internationally, We were told at the conference that our pollution in Namibia is poverty and inequality. Clearly, this is part of the objective of our development plans and our development agenda. And this is going to, we trust, going to be an outcome of the production of green hydrogen, because a town like Lutrecht can be turned into a real hub of economic activities with all the infrastructure that need to be built. SMEs can benefit from that. Small traders on the streets can benefit from that. A whole lot of jobs can be created. We have had about 15,000 jobs in the production process, the first phase. Those are the solutions to our social problems in Namibia.
That's Angie Skolt speaking to Cons Karamata, the CEO of EAN. And still coming up in the show, we'll be looking at Namib Mills turning 40, catching up with Ian Collard. Stay tuned.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to Nova 1035. It's the Business Report. Now, Namib Mills last week celebrated 40 years in business. The company, which started as Namib Mills, had humble beginnings and only produced maize meal and some corn flour products. Since then, billions have been invested into job creation, infrastructure, and an enormously wide variety of products. Our guest this evening is Namib Mills CEO Ian Collard. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Gary.
So tell us a little bit about, you would have had an opportunity recently with your 40th anniversary, congratulations, to think about the start of the company. Tell us a little bit about how the company came to be.
The company started in the early 80s of the previous century. And if I say it like that, it sounds that it's actually longer than we think. It started as a maize mill. And then it started to expand, because if you are milling maize, you're also sitting with offal, they call it omni chop. And then later on, we also started with a wheat flour mill, and there you've got an offal product that's called bran. And through that, Feedmaster then was actually coming on stream, because it's much better to make use of the offal and sell it as animal feeds. So that's what happened then. Really humble beginnings. When Namib Mills started, that premises was nearly at the end of town, as we knew it at that stage. I only think the Van Eyck power station was the only building in the area that was still north of us. Otherwise, there were nothing there. So, yes, humble, only in Windhoek. And Namib Mills then also started expanding by having a distribution network throughout the country. And then in 1995, they bought Utawi Mills from Agra. At that stage, it belonged to Agra. It was a mill built by Senwes Co-op of South Africa. So, and through that, that was actually rather the first time I think Namib Mills was spreading its wings to fly higher. That was about in 1995. But at that stage, we only had two products, and that was maize meal and wheat flour. And only a year after that, we got the third product in our basket, and that was sugar. It was not even our own sugar. It was sugar that was packed for us. And we only did the distribution. Contrary to popular belief at this stage, that sugar was marathon sugar, which currently is not distributed by us anymore, because the brand belongs to another group. So humble beginnings. I was there for most of the journey, not the whole journey, because I was still at school at that stage. And if I, so I wasn't allowed to work then. So yes, in the end, we then started to expand in all other products in order to make our basket a bit bigger and offer a bigger choice to our customers. When I started there, we were in the region of about 250 people to 300 people, and today we are 10 times more, about 2,500.
And of course, we know that that's not always linear. Sometimes the problems that emerge with staff is often exponential, that the bigger you get, the more complex things you get quickly. Now, as you speak to us, you're in Upington at the moment.
Yes.
You say you're suffering from load shedding, and so the network is crackling a little bit. But interestingly, Number of Mills also has footprint in South Africa and is also an exporter of goods into South Africa. And that's, you know, we're far more used to hearing about guys bringing stuff in from South Africa, but you guys have a footprint there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think in Namibia, we've got this, let's call it a mental block, and that is that you can only have full trucks coming into Namibia and not full trucks going out of Namibia. And I think we in a sense saw that as a challenge, that we should also start exporting other non-traditional products out of Namibia. And as we all know, that Namibia in the region only have 2.5 million people. And 2.5 million people in the current economy is not a very big market. So down to South Africa, South Africa's approximately 55 million people, and some people will tell you that it's actually more. So that gives us a big market for the products that we are already making. Unfortunately, not all of our products can be exported for long distances due to its level of profitability. But pasta is a product that is one of the products that can be exported to South Africa. So that's why we also have a product here in South Africa, and also a presence in South Africa. And then we also have a feed plant in South Africa that we manage for the market here. Because everything that we are used to in Namibia, you can multiply that by 30, 40 times to get to the size of South Africa. So from a marketing point of view or market point of view, it makes sense to do business here also.
So tell us a little bit about what's next. The markets are developing, as you say. You've got some tendrils going into the bigger markets south. We see agriculture developing in sort of fits and starts around us and in surrounding states as well. What's on the long-term horizon for Number of Mills?
Okay, unfortunately, as I've said earlier, that we are doing business in a country where the popular or market size is quite small. So for us to expand, we have actually two choices. The first thing is to try to expand our basket to sell more products in a small market. And then also try to expand geographically, and that is that you actually expand your size of your market. Now, we're trying to do both because just to do one, we don't think that that would be the best route to go. So that's why we are constantly trying to put some new products on the market, and then also trying to have a look at new markets outside of Namibia. So if we can give an example of that, new products for us at Number of Mills in Namibia was instant porridge, top yeah. score instant porridge, and then also the fresh bread that we are baking. Products that we are exporting is currently predominantly pasta, and then we're also exporting a bit of maize meal to Australia.
Wow.
So we're trying to do a bit of both. And incidentally, we're also exporting instant porridge to South Africa because the it does make business sense for us. So agriculture currently is what you can call in a good space. So regarding that, we would like to expand more in the, let's say, agribusiness side of the economy. So and that's also our passion. So if we do something new, it will be with regards to something agriculture and something food.
Okay. Listen, let's talk about food for a second. During COVID, would have been an incredibly trying time to run a business like yours. And I remember chatting to you at around about that time, because there's also an enormous, quite aside from the business elements of selling food to people, because you're so heavily geared into staples, you also carry an enormous responsibility to feed people. You, as an organization, as a company, you're an essential part of keeping the nation alive to a large extent. How does that responsibility factor into your sort of strategic thinking?
Well, it's very central in our strategic thinking, because if you just see the name Number of Moles, you will see that under the name there's a statement feeding the nation. And for us, that's actually a calling. We see it as a calling. And specifically during trying times like COVID, a lot of people will say, yes, it was actually quite difficult to do business. And in a sense, for Number of Moles, I don't think it was as difficult, because there's a saying that people say, we have to eat, which is good for us in a business sense. So that was good for us, or better compared to, let's say, the tourism industry, which at that stage was actually down in the dumps because nobody could travel. But we also said that although there is some risk or a lot of risk involved with the COVID pandemic that we had, with people that can get sick and so forth, the higher calling was still to supply the nation with food. And therefore, life actually went on as normal, but with a very big responsibility. And that is that if we have to suffer now with this pandemic, at least we could not let the nation suffer with going hungry with a non-availability of food. So for us, it's a calling.
Yeah, and as we look forward to the next decade, we get to speak to many kinds of business leaders on the show. And a question I like asking guys in charge of sectors or that are dominant in their spaces is, are you bullish or are you bearish over the next decade?
Well, sometimes if things are ongoing as planned, then a lot of people tend to get bearish about the outlook for the near future. But we try to see it in another way, and this is that if things are not going well, or things are not, but business is not flowing naturally, through that, it actually unlocks a lot of additional opportunities. Because if there is something that's not going as planned, there's an opportunity to rectify that, and then some, and also making some profits out of it. A very difficult or telling example for that is that I'm currently down in South Africa, and we have load shedding here, so there's not enough electricity. So if there's not enough electricity, whatever the reason may be, there's an opportunity to sell electricity after you've generated it. So through some difficult times and so, through some things that are happening that's distorting the norm, new opportunities arise. One of the opportunities that we also took was a subsidiary company of ours, Feedmaster, that was doing the COVID testing during the COVID pandemic. That was a business opportunity that actually arose through a difficult time. So if I'm positive, or we are not positive about business, then how can we take responsibility to manage and be the leader of the people that are working for Nomad Malls and the group?
Absolutely. Ian Collard, 40 years. Congratulations to you, your management team, and all your staff. Thank you for everything that Nomad Malls does in creating stable employment and, of course, feeding the nation. I know you're down in South Africa, so you're going to struggle to find a decent beer. And now that you're load shedded, you're going to struggle to find a cold one. So I wish you everything of the best this evening.
Thank you very much for your time.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. The Bank of Namibia increased the repo rate by 75 basis points to 5.5%. Minister of Industrialization and Trade, Lucia Pumbu, says her ministry and the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism have agreed on co-financing the rehabilitation of water supply points at the rundown state-owned Kavango Cattle Ranch in the Kavango West region. New vehicle sales dropped by 22.4% month-on-month in July 2022 to 677 units, while on an annual basis, vehicle sales declined by 15.3% year-on-year, dipping below the six-month moving average. The City of Windhoek has revealed that 93.9% of the 17,487 home seekers on their housing waiting list earn below $8,000 Namibian dollars. And Presidential Economic Advisor and Green Hydrogen Commissioner James Nupe says Namibia will soon kick off the construction of four pilot projects under the Green Hydrogen Strategy for Namibia, namely the Dara Agricultural Project, Namport Logistics Application Project, Clean Energy Refueling Project, and the Transnamib Logistics Project. A green hydrogen refueling service station will also be constructed in Walvis Bay, including a 5-megawatt photovoltaic solar system and a 5-megawatt electrolyzer, along with the station itself. South Africa's coal sales to Europe rose eightfold during the first half of 2022 compared with last year, as demand for the fossil fuel surged ahead of a ban on Russian coal. Staying in South Africa, the government announced a national ban on moving cattle to curb the spread of foot and mouth disease, which is among the world's most infectious animal illnesses, while the Congress of South African Trade Unions has urged workers to stand united in holding government and business leaders accountable instead of fighting against one another. Looking further afield, Uganda plans to import 60 megawatts of power from neighboring Kenya to avert an energy crisis brought on by the emergency shutdown of the Isimba hydropower dam due to technical failures. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a sweeping healthcare, tax, and climate package worth hundreds of billions of dollars, representing the largest climate investment in American history, with targets to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40% by the end of this decade. Japan's prime minister has ordered his new cabinet to tackle the mounting inflation problem as the economy shows signs of recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, with growth being driven by a rise in consumer spending. While China's premier has called on the country's economic powerhouse regions to boost growth to beat a COVID-19 slump, as retail spending and industrial output are both falling behind targets amid ongoing pandemic restrictions. And finally, in the UK, people reportedly feel they're on the brink of an economic and human catastrophe and that the government is completely asleep at the wheel. This, as the Bank of England forecast a recession that's set to last for more than a year, with inflation set to peak in excess of 13%, rising unemployment and falling real-term living standards. The country has also, though, launched a scheme to cut tariffs on hundreds of products from some of the world's poorest countries to try to boost trade links.
Now, we heard in David's business report that the Bank of Namibia has decided to increase the repo rate by 75 basis points to 5.5%. We asked independent economic researcher Rodney Huipe for his reaction to the announcement.
It is triggered by the U.S. raising the Fed rate's interest rates. And I also believe the timing is quite very bad and very challenging because the economic times does not allow for people to to surrender their disposable income just so that we can have a very strong monetary system. I think banks can take the pressure of having lower interest rates compared to average individuals that survive on $1,000 per month. So the banks really are geared to make revenue regardless. Even at 3%, banks can make revenue. But many individuals that are hurt by inflation cannot make an honest living in today's world. I think this was also done so the economies can escape recessions. So when they see there's a fear of recession, they decided, let's do this so that we can get more income, that we can escape recession. The recession in the sense of the economies are that GDPs are slugging behind, especially in the third quarter that has happened. And only in the fourth quarter shall we see quite a rampant recovery of economies, mostly. And I think it was also the tension between China and America relations, because what happened with the China-America relations is that China is withdrawing from backing the American reserve or the US dollar because they own most of the debt in America. I think America felt quite a bit of a fear against that, and then it triggered everything else in the world to strengthen itself.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
Another big show. Thank you to all our guests for making time to appear here on the Business Report. Thank you to those of you who've reached out via both Twitter and email, tbr@nova.com.na, to let us know what you think of the show, our topics, and if there's something you disagree with. We love hearing from you. As always, our thanks to our executive producer, Angie Skoltz, Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, but mostly to you for listening. Thanks for making this Namibia's leading business show. You can catch this episode if you missed something or you want to catch more of it. You can catch this and all of our previous episodes. That's on nova.com.na. Go to podcasts. Nova with a flashy new website, right? I don't know if you knew that, but it is sparking and spiffing, and there's a podcast button that you press it, and then our stuff pops up. And all 38 episodes will then be there for your consumption. The team decided we were going to take lunch at 50, but we think we might do it earlier. So thanks for getting us to that mile landmark that we can eat a free lunch on the boss's tab. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you again next week.
That was the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Struble and produced by Angie Skulls and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.